a great pleasure today to have Dr. Murray Raskin speak to us about mild TBI management strategies using prazosin for MTBI comorbidities. Dr. Raskin is the director of the Mental Health Illness Research, Education, and Clinical Center at the Puget Sound Veterans Administration, and he is as well professor of psychiatry and co-chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Washington. With that, we'll turn it over to Murray.
Thanks for the kind introduction, Dr. De Palma. And Molly, let's see, did... Okay, so for the poll questions, Molly, remind me again, take those, or do you want me to do that?
Yeah, so I'll go ahead and start with the poll questions. I'll take control back real quick. So for our attendees, we're going to go through a few poll questions real quick. So for the first one, we would like to get an idea of what your primary role in VA is. We understand that many of you wear many hats within the organization, so we'd like to get an idea of your primary role here. If your role is not listed on here, you at the end of the presentation, I will put up a feedback survey, and it will have a more extensive list of job titles, so you might find your exact one there to select. Looks like about 45% response rate with our attendees. We'll give people just a few more seconds. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close this out and share those results. So as you can see, we've got about 8% of our respondents identifying as clinician prescribers, 52% clinician non-prescriber, 4% pharmacist, 24% non-clinician research investigator, 12% student trainee or fellow.
Yeah, hi.
And Murray, did you want to make any comments on that before we move on to the next
So the clinician prescribers obviously are caught in this bad snowstorm on the East Coast. So, but it's good to have whomever is here, because I think that the information will be useful.
Great, thank you. Yes, we are getting quite the storm here. Okay, so I'm going to jump to the next poll question. So this is for those that identified as a prescriber. If you are a prescriber, have you prescribed prazosin in your practice? Okay, looks like we've got a pretty even split here. In fact, we've got an exact even split. We have 50% saying yes and 50% saying no.
Okay, good. So we'll at least we have some experience with prazosin, and we'll see if we can hone the information.
Thank you. Okay, we'll get to our third poll question here. Sorry, one second.
Right now, we're down to a fairly small number to whom this this slide is directed. But I put this one in because, in general, prazosin often is underdosed, and we use higher doses often than others do. All right, that's good. That suggests that
the dosing
is moving.
All right, looks like 38% of our respondents said 3 to 5 milligrams, about 50% said 6 to 10 milligrams, and about 13% said 11 to 20 milligrams. So thank you to those respondents. We're going to go ahead and jump to our last poll question here. This one, you can select multiple answer options. So if you have prescribed prazosin, I know I keep mispronouncing it, I apologize.
I'm not sure anybody knows the correct pronunciation, so all are acceptable.
Excellent. I like that. So for what indication have you prescribed it? Go ahead and check all that apply. PTSD, alcohol use disorder, post mild TBI headaches, disruptive agitation in dementia. And go ahead and give people a few more seconds to get their replies in. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close that out and share these last poll results. So 83% of our respondents selected PTSD, 8% selected alcohol use disorder, 25% post-MTBI headaches, and 8% disruptive agitation in dementia.
Hey,
so thank you once again. And Murray, you're going to get that pop-up one last time to show your screen. Go ahead and click on that. So let me clear
okay.
this out first.
Let's see. I see my – wait.
Sorry, 1 second. I made a small error.
Take your time. Usually I'm the one making the errors on the – aha, show my screen. Okay. Are we in business?
Thank you. We are.
Good. All right. I'm going to get past the poll questions. So the Prayson story for the veteran population began in service members and veterans who had been deployed to Vietnam. My first experience that led to using Brazosin was in my role as the facilitator of a large African-American/Black veterans support group here at VA Puget Sound. And most of the men in the group had post-traumatic stress disorder. And many of them also had experienced mild traumatic brain injuries, but it wasn't getting as much publicity at the time as it is now. But looking back, the comorbidity of a post-traumatic stress disorder and MTBI, which is about 70% in the Iraq-Afghanistan veteran population, probably approached that in the Vietnam veteran population as well. So as I was learning about post-traumatic stress disorder from the veterans in my group, it became increasingly clear that what they were experiencing, especially at night, was what they described as a brain adrenaline rush that was associated with nightmares of their combat trauma experiences and also caused distressed awakenings. Now, this acute brain adrenaline rush, or more neurotransmitter accurately norepinephrine rush, the job of norepinephrine release in the brain is to increase one's level of arousal and vigilance to especially novel stimuli in the environment. And as you can imagine, in a combat situation, being at the at a high level of arousal and vigilance to things that would suggest that you're approaching and what could be potentially a deadly ambush is incredibly important and saves lives in combat. Unfortunately, it appears that this increased arousal and vigilance for many veterans doesn't go away just because one has returned to the United States. And this persistent hypervigilance and increased arousal is an important component of combat trauma post-traumatic stress disorder. The first veteran who ever received Prazosin was, and still is actually, Don, who was an infantry man in the 1st Infantry Division, and he experienced multiple horrific combat traumas during the Tet Offensive. One particularly devastating was during a firefight around from his M16 assault rifle accidentally hit his best friend, and his friend died before he could be medevaced away. And Don in the group was having horrific nightly nightmares of this and other combat traumas, and felt terrible remorse, had actually had intense suicidal ideation, and was self-medicating with large amounts of alcohol. And this story may sound familiar to those who are clinicians who are caring for combat veterans from Vietnam and other theaters. Okay, this is sort of the infomercial side. I just got a Christmas card from Don. This is actually the 2016 Christmas card, but he's been on prednisone 5 milligrams twice a day and 10 milligrams at night for the past 22 years, and no more nightmares, sleeping well, suicidal ideation gone, and he's not had a drop of alcohol in the past 22 years. So once he was stabilized on prednisone, the alcohol use disorder and the suicidal ideation and the horrific nighttime PTSD symptoms were eliminated. Now, you might think I rationally got directly to this treatment strategy, but actually I took a bit of a left turn when I realized that, yes, he was having an adrenaline or norepinephrine storm at night and too high brain norepinephrine activity during the day. But the literature really guided me towards using a drug that was not prednisone, but a drug called propranolol, which blocks the other receptor for norepinephrine in the brain, and that's the beta receptor. So propranolol blocks the beta receptor, and prednisone is a blocking drug for the alpha-1 receptor, and these are the two main receptor types for norepinephrine in the brain that mediates arousal and vigilance. So I gave Don propranolol, and I got him up to 20 milligrams twice a day, and I remember this quote very well. "Doc, we are going the wrong direction. My nightmares are even worse." So I looked at the – I went immediately to the physician's desk reference. Does anybody remember Books, who's on the line? For those of you who are a little bit older, the physician's desk reference contained all of the side effects of any drug, and I went to propranolol, and to my surprise and somewhat to my chagrin, fifth down on the list of side effects of propranolol was intensifies dreams. So the next step was based on some work that we, my colleague, Dr. Elaine Peskind and I had been doing in Alzheimer's disease, where we had been looking at norepinephrine brain system regulation of cognition. And we knew that the beta receptor for norepinephrine and the alpha-1 receptor for norepinephrine, when stimulated, often had opposite effects. So prednisone was really the only available choice of a blocker of the alpha-1 receptor in the brain that was clinically available and that was able to pass from blood into brain when taken orally. So I wasn't extremely optimistic that this would help, but Don had higher blood pressure than one would like, so prednisone, which had been introduced as an antihypertensive, was reasonable, at least for that indication. We tried it, and the question was, would blocking brain alpha-1 adrenergic receptors with prednisone suppress the horrific trauma nightmares that Don was experiencing? Just a few words about prednisone as background. It's a generic drug, so it's inexpensive. It's been around since 1970. It's lipid-soluble, so drugs that are able to dissolve in fat, if you will, are the drugs that cross from the, that cross the blood-brain barrier relatively easily. And it was introduced as Minipress, that was the brand name before it went generic, for the treatment of hypertension. It's also been used by probably more than a million older men as a treatment for benign prostatic hypertrophy, urinary outflow hesitancy. So it has a long track record of safe use in older men. It has a short duration of action, which because at the time the target was nighttime nightmares and distressed awakening PTSD symptoms, that seemed a good thing. And we'll talk more about that later. And it costs pennies per day. So costing pennies per day is a good thing, but it's also a difficult thing when one wants to get pharmaceutical company support for a clinical trial to evaluate efficacy of a drug such as prednisone. So we were on our own. So I just go over the course. Prednisone was begun at 1 milligram at bedtime. And the reason it's important to start with a low dose, preferably 1 milligram, is to avoid what's called first dose hypotension. So there's a first dose effect where prednisone, when first taken, will sometimes induce dizziness and can even induce loss of consciousness if one arises too rapidly from a lying or sitting position to a standing position. So one has to start low with prednisone, but then gradually, and we do it over a 2 to 4 week period, gradually increase the dose, titrating against clinical efficacy and absence of adverse effects. In Don's case, after 2 weeks of gradual prednisone dose increase, he got up to 6 milligrams and the nightmares disappeared. I was sure that this was the placebo effect, and I said to myself, yeah, I didn't realize I was such an excellent group psychotherapist. But in fact, our experience and studies over the past two decades have demonstrated that this was, in fact, not an accident. It was actually a beneficial therapeutic effect of prednisone. I should mention that prednisone, when it works, it keeps on working. You may have to increase the dose somewhat over time, but and actually I have to update the slide because I say this veteran continues nightmare-free, suicidal ideation-free, and alcohol-free for the past 20 years, but it should be 22 years at this point, on 5 milligrams twice a day and 10 milligrams at bedtime. And anecdotally, in the group, several more veterans with a similar picture had similar benefit from prednisone, and this benefit was long-lasting. A word about sleep physiology of trauma nightmares and post-traumatic stress disorder. So trauma nightmares appear to arise from disrupted rapid eye movement sleep. So as you may know, rapid eye movement sleep is the stage of sleep from which most of our normal, bizarre, strange dreams that we all have arise. Trauma nightmares will probably arise from different stages of sleep, either REM sleep that's disrupted or from light sleep. In animal studies, alpha-1 stimulation, remember we're talking about the alpha-1 receptor for norepinephrine. So if you stimulate the alpha-1 receptor with a drug called methoxamine, you disrupt REM sleep. And if we can ask the animals who were in the studies whether they're having nightmares, they probably would say yes, and also lengthens light sleep. So these effects are consistent with the type of sleep physiology from which trauma nightmares arise. And in the animal studies, these effects were reversed by prednisone. We did a study in humans with PTSD, and this was both civilian and a combination of civilian and military PTSD that was led by our colleague Fletcher Taylor. And just want to point out a few things on the slide. So total sleep time in these participants who had post-traumatic stress disorder and had severe sleep disruption accompanied by trauma nightmares, total sleep time increased by 93 minutes, over an hour and a half. But prazosin is not a medication that gets you to sleep. So if we look at the third set of bars on the slide, sleep latency, if anything, it took a few minutes longer to get to sleep with prazosin than with placebo. But total sleep time was substantially increased. And the what one sees clinically is that persons treated successfully with prazosin for trauma nightmares and sleep disruption in the context of PTSD will report that their sleep is much less interrupted. They sleep more consistently and have a longer duration and feel that sleep has been more restful and restorative. Well, this anecdotal clinical experience led to now seven placebo-controlled trials for PTSD with nightmares and or sleep disturbance, and six of them have been positive with high effect sizes. Unfortunately, we did a VA cooperative study, which will be coming out in the New England Journal of Medicine next month, which failed. And I want to talk a little bit about that one, and that will introduce us perhaps to why we're now talking about personalized or precision medicine as an approach to identifying which persons with PTSD, with or without it's being a comorbidity for mild traumatic brain injury, will respond to prazosin and which are less likely to respond. But more about the VA cooperative study. This is a 6-month randomized controlled trial of prazosin in 304 veterans, mostly Vietnam veterans, who had been in combat theaters and who reported nightmares that were related to their trauma. The study did not fail because of giving too little prazosin, because we used a pretty substantial dose. Unfortunately, we did not find that prazosin was superior to placebo for the outcomes of PTSD nightmares, overall PTSD symptoms, and clinical global impression of change. So in scratching our heads, trying to figure out why this was so different from our previous studies and our clinical experience, we came to some, these are hypotheses, but they seem to fit with what our participants at the 12 VA sites told us. There was reluctance of providers to refer veterans who were in great distress or had unstable domestic or legal or occupational problems to a study which was 6 months in duration, and therefore one could be on placebo for 6 months. So many of the persons who were highly distressed and unstable who had trauma nightmares in the context of post-traumatic stress disorder were just put on open-label prazosin outside of the study. And what we found when we looked at the population was that what we saw in many of the veterans in our early studies, that is evidence of high noradrenergic activity with relatively high blood pressure, high incidence of alcohol self-medication and benzodiazepine use just to try to calm things down, was not the case in this population. The veterans in the co-op study had relatively low blood pressure, low alcohol use, so their audit C score, if you're familiar with it, was 2. So they were reporting drinking one or two drinks a week, so they were drinking less than the investigators, as far as I can tell, and had only a 10% benzodiazepine use, whereas in the whole VA population of PTSD patients, it's closer to 30%. And we had actually put in as an exclusion criterion because of our concern about safety, that psychosocially unstable veterans were excluded. Therefore, there's a good chance we selected against the adrenergic subtype of post-traumatic stress disorder. There's one thing that came out of the study, which was, important as a testable hypothesis in the future, and that was incident or new suicidal ideation with onset during the trial was significantly lower in the prednisone condition than in the placebo condition, and we'll be following up on that. I mentioned earlier that the pharmaceutical industry has never been interested in prednisone because it's a generic off-patent drug. But despite that, over the years since 2001, when we published our first case reports, the utilization across VA has increased every year and is now plateaued at approximately 15% of all veterans in VA healthcare system with a PTSD diagnosis are prescribed prednisone. All right, now to OIF, OEF, Afghanistan, Iraq population, where we have a substantial a comorbidity of PTSD in the context of traumatic brain injury and vice versa. This is the banner of that advertised a randomized controlled trial we did in active duty soldiers at Joint Base Lewis-McChord, comparing prednisone and placebo for PTSD with nightmares. And in this study, I'll just take you down to the bottom bullet. The majority of the participants, 75%, had comorbid mild traumatic brain injury. So the results of this study, I think, can reasonably be extrapolated to veterans and other persons who have experienced blast or blunt trauma or both mild traumatic brain injury and much more commonly injuries because most of them had multiple exposures to MTBI head trauma. This is a 15-week parallel group trial. And the maximum dose, similar to our, a little bit higher actually than in our co-op study, 5 milligrams in the morning and 20 milligrams at night. And most of our subjects got pretty close to those doses, and they were quite well tolerated in this sample. And the results of this trial were highly positive. So up in the left-hand corner, that box shows the results for the clinician-administered PTSD scale nightmare item. There was a substantial reduction in the prednisone group. And because placebo ain't a bad drug either, there was a slight reduction in the placebo group of about 15%, but nowhere near what we saw in the prednisone group, and this was a highly significant difference. The same thing for sleep measured by the Pittsburgh Sleep Quality Index, and for overall total CAPS PTSD score was also significantly greater response to prednisone than to placebo. I want to take you to the lower left-hand box, which is the clinical global impression of change. So, which was anchored to how are you functioning at home and at work compared to before you were put on one of the medications. So 64% of the prednisone subjects compared to only 27% of the placebo subjects said they were either moderately or markedly improved in overall ability to function, which we thought was an exciting result. But it was still true that even though 64% of the prednisone randomized subjects demonstrated a moderate to marked improvement, on this slide you can see that 36% of those randomized to prednisone were non-responders. And we felt it was important to try to identify what characteristics prior to randomization in the trial would help us predict who would respond to prednisone and who would not respond to prednisone. And we looked at clinical characteristics, PTSD signs and symptoms on the CAPS, and neither the distribution of PTSD symptoms nor the quantitative severity of PTSD symptoms differentiated those who were responders versus non-responders. So then we asked, is there an accessible biologic variable or biomarker that would help us predict the therapeutic response to prednisone? And remember, prednisone, we know a little bit about what prednisone does in the brain. It blocks the effects of norepinephrine. So we at least had a clue as to what brain neurotransmitter system we should explore. And we assumed that excessive brain alpha-1 adrenoreceptor activity, that is, excessive response of the alpha-1 adrenoreceptor to norepinephrine, contributes to PTSD, hyperarousal, and trauma nightmare symptoms. So we said, great, we can just do a PET brain scan and measure the alpha-1 receptor, and those with high levels of alpha-1 receptor activity would be prednisone responders because they'd have the biologic target. Unfortunately, the brain alpha-1 adrenoreceptor cannot be measured currently by PET scan or any other neuroimaging or other modality because there is no PET ligand or other technology that will allow us to do this. So we had to be a bit creative and move outside the brain to the rest of the body. And remember that prednisone was introduced as a drug to treat high blood pressure by blocking the alpha-1 adrenoreceptor response to norepinephrine on the blood vessels that control blood pressure and regulate blood pressure, especially when one changes from a supine to a standing position. So we assumed that peripheral vascular alpha-1 adrenoreceptor activity contributes to blood pressure regulation in these soldiers as in other persons, particularly in the standing position. And unlike the brain alpha-1 adrenoreceptor, standing blood pressure is easily measured. So our hypothesis was that higher standing pretreatment blood pressure would predict greater PTSD symptom reduction by prednisone. And this hypothesis was bolstered by the fact that the brain norepinephrine system and the peripheral other parts of the body norepinephrine system are co-regulated, so they tend to work together. It turned out that this hypothesis was correct. So pretreatment standing systolic blood pressure strongly predicted PTSD response to prednisone. For every 10 millimeters of mercury, the unit of measurement for blood pressure, increase in pretreatment systolic blood pressure, there was an additional 14-point reduction in total CAP score, and this was highly significant. And to put this in terms of the actual blood pressures measured, and if the soldier had a standing systolic blood pressure of 130 millimeters of mercury, they had a 36-point reduction in their clinician-administered PTSD scale score, which was about a 50% reduction and fairly dramatic. On the other hand, if their standing systolic blood pressure was low, only 110 millimeters of mercury, they had only a 7-point CAPS reduction. And this 7-point reduction was actually less robust than the 11-point reduction we saw in soldiers randomized to placebo. So it really didn't work in those folks who had a low standing systolic blood pressure. Now, we're not saying that hypertension or high blood pressure is necessary to predict a good response to prednisone, because if you look at the middle chevron, a standing systolic of 120 millimeters of mercury still predicted a good reduction, which was a significant and clinically meaningful reduction in PTSD symptoms. So what we're saying is that a higher standing systolic blood pressure, or probably a sitting blood pressure, works as well, which is higher than one would expect for the patient's demographic group, will help you predict that that person will be a good responder to prednisone, provided they have the target symptoms, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. Just to mention that in the placebo group, there was no effect of pretreatment standing systolic blood pressure on total CAP score response. So this is very specific to the prednisone group. So bottom line, a higher pretreatment standing blood pressure for a PTSD or alcohol use disorder patient's demographic groups, an accessible biomarker that helps predict therapeutic response to prednisone or doxazosin. We may have missed a slide, but I'll check in a second. So doxazosin is a cousin of prednisone. It was introduced later. It's a longer-acting alpha-1 adrenal receptor antagonist. It crosses the blood-brain barrier, although not as well as prednisone, but if you take your time, it will get into the brain. And it also is being used more and more for PTSD and other indications for prednisone. I mentioned that I would tell you a little bit about the symptoms that can also help you predict which patient may respond best to prednisone. And I want to give some credit to Colonel Vince Myslevich, who was a good colleague at Joint Base Lewis McChord and now is based in San Antonio, is the consultant for sleep disorders to the Army Surgeon General. And he published a paper in 2014 which summarized things that we'd observed in our clinical practice as well. And he coined the phrase trauma-associated sleep disorder. That includes a couple of features. The most easily elicited clinically is disruptive nocturnal behaviors that include distress vocalizations, shouting out in sleep, often in a combative way or in a way that reflects a presumed nightmare that involves struggling. Somnambulism, sleepwalking, and actual body combative behaviors, using large muscles, striking out, and often terrifying one's bed partners so that they've long ago learned to sleep in another room. These large muscle behaviors and movements are unexpected during nightmares, because as you probably know, during REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, in normal dreams, our bodies are relatively paralyzed, and our eyes are going back and forth, but our large muscles are not moving. So Dr. Myslevich, using sleep polysomnography, demonstrated that these trauma-associated sleep disorder folks, during REM sleep, did not lose their muscle tone. What he called REM sleep without atonia, and that there was more muscle tone than one would expect. The second bullet, large bullet to the left, is perhaps the easiest thing to elicit clinically, and that is a history of trauma nightmares and or distressed awakenings with autonomic arousal. So the norepinephrine effects mediated by our autonomic or sympathetic nervous system are present when veterans are awakened from their nightmare or have a distressed awakening, even if they don't recall a nightmare. These include sweating, rapid heart rate, and vigilance, and the necessity to get up and check the perimeter. Okay. I want to switch now to another comorbidity, a very important one, and that is alcohol use disorder. And these studies are a sample of the ones that I've done with our colleagues in the CSATE, the Center for Substance Abuse Treatment and Education here at VA Puget Sound. They also have built on some important studies done by our bench laboratory colleague, Dennis Rasmussen, in which he's demonstrated that prazosin reduces alcohol drinking in genetically alcohol-preferring rats, and that combining naltrexone and prazosin in a single oral medication decreases alcohol drinking more effectively than does either drug alone. So prazosin is playing an increasing role in alcohol use disorder, and I'll just show you some data from the first study we've done. We've now done two more positive studies, some larger than this one. This is the first one, and in this one, Dr. Simpson, who's a clinical psychologist and a superb psychotherapist, led this psychopharmacologic study, and she convinced us all that a rapid titration over 2 weeks to 4 milligrams twice a day and 8 milligrams a night was the way to go. We've slowed down a bit since then, but in fact, prazosin was effective for alcohol ingestion in this population of alcohol use disorder veterans. And as you can see in the green, there was a significantly greater decrease in drinking in the prazosin group than in the placebo group. And what we've seen in our latter studies is that the most prazosin responsive drinking parameter is days of heavy drinking, which is, of course, the days which cause the most trouble. And we talked about doxazosin earlier, the doxazosin study that was done by our colleagues at the Providence VA, Bob Swift and his group. Demonstrated that standing blood pressure also predicted the prazosin response in persons with alcohol use disorder. As I mentioned, the most consistent effect of prazosin for alcohol use disorder is on heavy drinking, and combining prazosin with naltrexone or propranolol likely is more effective than prazosin alone. So we've got a study of prazosin plus naltrexone ongoing. We won't have data for a while, sometimes using things clinically that make sense even before the randomized controls come out is helpful. Aha! Our doxazosin slide has finally appeared. This was a study, done at the Providence VA. And doxazosin, again, as a reminder, is an alpha-1 antagonist with longer duration of action than prazosin. And in this study, higher standing pretreatment diastolic blood pressure. Remember, we did systolic, they did diastolic. It probably doesn't matter very much, but they did a median split at greater than 80 millimeters of mercury. And you want to be 80 or below for normal blood pressure. The higher standing blood pressure predicted significant reductions in heavy drinking days and drinks per week. Okay, we told you about that. Okay, all right, let me talk about headaches. And hopefully no one's getting a headache listening to this talk. So we have an ongoing trial of prazosin for persistent post-concussive headaches. Here at VA Puget Sound and at Joint Base Lewis McChord in both veterans and active duty soldiers. And this was not our idea. This came from work that our good colleague Robert Ruff initially did when he was the head of VA neurology and the acting head of VA rehabilitation medicine. And he did an open label study of Prazosin for what he started as using Prazosin in OIF-OEF veterans whom he was seeing as a neurologist for their post-mild traumatic brain injury PTSD symptoms. He also measured the very prominent problem of headache. And I put the headache on top in this slide. So this was Dr. Ruff's and his wife Suzanne Ruff's open-label prazosin sleep hygiene trial for OIF-OEF veterans with blast MTBI and comorbid PTSD. So headaches per month on 7 milligrams titrated up to a dose of 7 milligrams of prazosin over 7 weeks produced a substantial reduction in headaches per month, headache intensity, and daytime sleepiness. This is my favorite result. Percent subjects with restful and restorative sleep. At baseline, only 7% of these veterans reported they were having a good night's sleep. And at week 9, on 7 milligrams of prazosin, it was close to 88%. And they even did better on the cognition test. They did the on the Montreal Cognitive Assessment. They improved 4 points. So my grandmother would have been happy with these results because she said a good night's sleep really helps everything. And it's probably the best explanation of what was going on here. But remember, this is an open label study, and they can be misleading, or at least can exaggerate results. So it's necessary to do a placebo-controlled trial. And that's exactly what we're embarking on at the present time. So fortunately, we received funding from the VA for a career development award for neurologist Cynthia Mayer, and we were awarded DOD, congressionally mandated research program award, to do this study. So it's a, you know, it's again, it's this, the main point is this is a placebo-controlled clinical trial, but I must tell you that even though we have completed a few subjects to this point, we are encouraged. And I'm not sure how much time I have left. Maybe can I take a few minutes, perhaps, just to go through some what are they called? Clinical pearls. They used to be called clinical pearls for using prazosin.
Yeah, not a problem.
Okay. Thanks, Molly. So you have to, even if you start low, you have to not leave veterans who are not responding at a low dose without gradually increasing the dose to see if at a higher dose the target symptoms will improve. And while you're doing this, you don't have to do compulsive blood pressure measurements. What you have to do is patient education. You have to teach patients that if they're getting up from a lying or sitting position, especially when they're first starting prazosin, sit on the edge of the bed for 30 seconds. If you feel fine, you're not lightheaded or dizzy, stand by the bed for an additional 30 seconds. If you're lightheaded, sit down until it goes away, then you're good to go. The nasal congestion is a side effect of prazosin. It's unusual, but it can happen. And the judicious use of nasal decongestants is what I recommend. Others worry about people getting dependent on Afrin and other drugs. But I found that it can be very helpful, especially when nasal congestion is interfering with sleep. Prazosin also can increase heart rate a little bit and increase the sensation that you feel your heart beating rapidly. And adding low dose of our old friend propranolol, which increased trauma nightmares without prazosin, but once prazosin on board, can calm this rapid heart rate, can be helpful for this adverse effect. Now, there are other drugs that which can cause dizziness when you stand up, and the most prominent among them are the erectile dysfunction drugs, Viagra and Prince. They also may slightly increase risk of priapism from Prince, which is a very low risk but should be kept in mind, especially for young male patients. If they're using testosterone replacement for some reason, or in our military population are using muscle vasodilators prior to going to the gym. So we've had some experience with those unusual but have to be kept in mind situations. In the older population, of course, they're often on other antihypertensives, and sometimes those have to be lowered when you're adding the praise. So if you're a prescribing psychiatrist, you have to work with the primary care medicine physician to come up with an optimal antihypertensive regimen. Dehydration should be avoided. Careful with hot tubs and hot baths because they're vasodilators too. And I've mentioned the exercise supplements. Priapism, an erection that lasts too long, is rare, but instruct to receive an emergency room evaluation if the erection persists for, if the literature says 4 hours, but it becomes painful and is lasting a long time. And trazodone may slightly increase priapism risk, so if you can stop trazodone for those patients who are taking trazodone for help with sleep, that's ideal. But it's not totally essential. Now, a few interesting things. As trauma nightmares disappear with Bradenton treatment, long absent normal dreams with typical bizarre content, be it pleasant or unpleasant, reappear. So I think it's important that veterans be reassured that an anxiety dream that they haven't had since going to Vietnam and which reappears is to be expected, and normal dreaming is probably a good thing. But trauma nightmares can be conceptualized as re-traumatizing, and so I consider them probably not a good thing. And the benefit of praziquantel in eliminating trauma nightmares and stress awakening may be more than just symptomatic, because re-traumatization, we know, worsens PTSD. And finally, it's not just a nighttime drug. For persistent daytime hyperarousal symptoms, adding low-dose mid-morning or BID praziquantel can be substantially beneficial for patients with daytime PTSD hyperarousal symptoms. And that's the end of my presentation. Thank you for your attention, and for those in the East Coast for dealing with the blizzard.
Well, thank you so much for coming on and lending your expertise. For our attendees, to submit your questions or comments, please go to the GoToWebinar control panel on the right-hand side of your screen. Just click the arrow next to the word questions. That will expand the dialog box, and you can then submit your question or comment there. Murray, do you have a contact slide you can keep up?
Let's see, a contact slide. So,
or just something with like your
contact slide. I blew that one, didn't I? Okay, so.
No, not a problem. You can just put it on the last slide you had up.
Okay, so hold on. We're working on that. But, you know, basically, just email me. It's murray.raskin@va.gov. That'll work. And let's see. So,
all right,
So we have two physicians hopelessly failing it.
So how do I get the presentation back up, Molly? I can put it on the
Just come out of it. Just press escape. And that should take you out of full screen mode.
Oh, here we go.
There you go. Okay. Yeah, you can just type it there on the last slide. And while they do that, Murray, we do have some questions for you.
Sure.
Any concerns that adding prazosin to patients already on mirtazapine
That was pronounced correctly. So mirtazapine is an antidepressant, and it really, although it should have some hypotensive effects, it doesn't seem to. I don't think that's the problem. It hasn't been in our experience. And again, when you're starting prazosin, the only thing you really need to be concerned about is when you're starting the drug is quote unquote first dose or first week's dose hypotension. And to be on the safe side, I'm very strict about coaching to get up gradually and make sure that you're not dizzy before you head to the bathroom or wherever you're going.
Molly, I have the contact lined up if you want to give us that control.
Excellent. We actually do see it, so thank you very much for taking care of that. Can we tell the difference in the office between REM sleep behavior disorder and trauma nightmares? They're treated differently, right?
Yeah, so REM sleep behavior disorder is often seen, well, I don't know how often it's seen, but it's more associated with Parkinson's disease and is treated with long-acting benzodiazepines in general. If a person, in the context of PTSD doesn't have Parkinson's disease, I think it's reasonable to assume if they're having distressed awakenings with high autonomic activity, with or without recall, trauma nightmares, that a trial of prazosin is warranted. And, there are always some patients who are confusing. Sometimes it's a bit of a trial and error thing to treat. Now, obviously, in the context of Parkinson's disease, that's a different story, and you have to start with a REM behavioral disorder approach with long-acting benzodiazepine.
Thank you. The next question, what are the effects to be on prazosin then taken off?
Not much. If you have a stuffy nose, your nose clears. So there's no rebound hypertension that one sees with some other antihypertensives such as clonidine or even propranolol, where there's some concern about rebound problems with both cardiac and blood pressure. And in fact, most veterans who get better with prazosin don't believe it. And they stop it themselves, and then the nightmares come back, and then they go back on it, and they may or may not tell their provider, but that's been our experience, and we haven't seen problems with withdrawal.
Thank you. Will this help a person focus better on a task or no effect if taken daily? I'm in school, but I can't stay focused on what I'm doing.
Yeah. So, the answer is, well, in two parts. One, there are no real data, at least in humans, on prazosin effects. But a good night's sleep is helpful for how you perform during the day. And I think when you think about norepinephrine in the brain, not enough norepinephrine will be problematic in terms of attention and concentration, which is why attention deficit kids respond to drugs such as amphetamines and methylphenidate that increase norepinephrine. And some traumatic brain injury veterans also respond with increased attention and ability to concentrate with some of the psychostimulant drugs. But then if you overshoot, you have an inverted U-shaped curve, and too much norepinephrine impairs concentration and ability to attend to a task. So it's, you know, it doesn't fit neatly into a paradigm. But if there is hypervigilance during the day, irritability hypervigilance during the day, and sleep disruption with autonomic arousal at night, one would predict that prazosin would be helpful for daytime function. And that's what, you know, on the clinical global impression, our soldiers reported that they were doing better in terms of their home and work function on prazosin, especially compared to placebo.
Thank you. We are at the top of the hour, but I still have four pending questions. Are you able to stay on and answer those for the recording?
Absolutely.
Excellent. If any of our attendees need to drop off at the top of the hour, please, when you exit the session, wait just a second while the feedback survey populates on your screen and take just a moment to answer those few questions. The next question we have here. The current updated PTSD guideline, which came out this year, discouraged mid-morning/daytime dosing of prazosin. Yeah. Thoughts, suggestions?
Yeah, well, I think they're misguided. So I talked at length with Matt Friedman about this, and they were essentially written by Matt. And, you know, he was somewhat overwhelmed by our negative VA cooperative study. But to put this into context, the guidelines recommend SSRIs, especially sertraline and paroxetine. And Matt's own study, multi-center study similar to our cooperative study of sertraline in 200 veterans, was totally negative. In fact, placebo folks did a little bit better, but not significantly so than the sertraline folks did. So I think there's a problem with all of our VA cooperative studies that they select out a non-responder population, because we're saying the same thing in VA cooperative studies with prolonged exposure psychotherapy for PTSD, and naltrexone for alcohol use disorder, and depot antipsychotics for schizophrenia. These studies have all come out negative when all other studies have come out positive. So I think it'll be interesting to see if the VA guidelines have any impact on prazosin utilization 2 years from now. We'll just see. Just to reiterate, I think in this case the guidelines are I would ignore them.
Thank you. The next person writes, fascinating. I'm a mid-level practitioner, and I've used prazosin with female patients with PTSD from sexual trauma, and observed the same response, and was specifically excited to see decreased hypervigilance with low-dose daytime dosing. The dosing recommendations / pearls for guiding dose titration were quite helpful. Thank you.
Wow, you're welcome, and thank you. And have that forwarded to Matt Friedman and the guideline committee.
Thank you.
Just kidding. We had some other people write.
Okay. There were a few other people that agreed with your contention there and wrote in to say so. The next question, have you considered doing a study of prazosin in conjunction with psychotherapy? Would psychotherapy have additional benefit?
Yeah, so I think that would be a great study to do. Being 10 years post-retirement age and doing a lot of other studies, I'm not sure I have the bandwidth to take that on, but I'd be delighted to collaborate with others. And I think our questions, our most important questions are which types of clinical pictures predict response to psychotherapy, which predict response to prazosin, and which predict a better response when you combine both. I do think good psychotherapy, and, you know, I don't have biases toward which one. I mean, it could be prolonged exposure, cognitive processing therapy, problem-solving therapy, present-centered therapy, all of which seem to give, you know, roughly when done in the same context, roughly the same good results, but not for everybody, which is what we also see with prazosin. So trying to get a personalized approach. But I do think that in general for psychiatric disorders, good psychotherapy plus good medication have the highest probability of helping the most people. But there's some people who, you know, medications are aversive to them and push them the wrong way. And the same can be true for some types of psychotherapy, even ones that are very effective in, you know, in randomized controlled trials. So we have a lot to learn in that regard, and that's an excellent question and an excellent direction to go.
Thank you. Do you accelerate the rate of titration if a patient has a gap in adherence and needs to restart? What length of non-adherence would you consider the need to retitrate?
Yeah. Well, you know, Dr. Peskin and I tend to differ. I tend to be a little more cavalier about it. But I think that, you know, if someone misses 2 or 3 days, I keep them at the same dose. But if it gets to be a week, I'll go back to start a lower dose, but I titrate more rapidly because they're better educated and more in tune with what adverse effects they might have to look for themselves. And I think this tolerance to the orthostatic hypotension, you know, it lasts, but there are no data suggesting how long it lasts. So you could be cautious, but I just work individually with the veteran and make sure that they know what to look for, and also how distressed are they by their nightmares. You know, I don't want to get someone better a week sooner but have them have a fall. So you have to individualize it. But it's a good question and one we wrestle with as well.
Thank you. This is a more generic question. Although I think your presentation generally supports a precision medicine paradigm, could you more directly comment the link? Perhaps put it another way, what lasting precision medicine message would you like to share given all these great findings?
Yeah, okay. Well, good question. So what we want to be looking for is evidence of enhanced norepinephrine activity in the brain. I think that's a subtype of, you know, I don't think every person who meets the DSM criteria for PTSD has this norepinephrine or noradrenergic subtype. So we're looking for norepinephrine effects. And fortunately, the norepinephrine system in the periphery reflects the norepinephrine system in the brain, so that evidence of heightened autonomic nervous system activation and heightened arousal in general. So we're looking at higher levels of blood pressure, not necessarily high, but higher levels of blood pressure. We're looking for autonomic nervous system or enhanced norepinephrine activity at night with sweating in bed and waking up distressed emotionally, accompanied by sweating and a increased heart rate, because norepinephrine also increases heart rate. I mean, think about drinking 10 cups of coffee and what does that do to one? High levels of motor activity. So some of my best prazosin responders, heavy combat special operations guys, haven't had a woman yet, but I will probably soon. They have trouble sitting still in your office, and just have this, their motor's running too fast. So I think that's what we're looking for when we're talking about precision medicine. Now, the measurable variable is blood pressure, and that is a especially in the standing position. Our mild traumatic brain injury veterans often have the trifecta, if you will, of comorbid PTSD, alcohol use disorder, and post-concussive persistent headaches. Prazosin is useful for at least some of these veterans. So it's a nice thing to keep in the armamentarium. Now, just a final note about precision medicine. You know, this comes from cancer, where we're looking at genetic variants that predict treatment to an anti-neoplastic or anti-cancer chemotherapy agent. And we're not at that stage with behavioral disorders. So I think we have to look more at clinical syndromes and physiology. And the physiology ones are the blood pressure, and much more difficult, of course, as I mentioned during the talk, is REM sleep without loss of muscle tone. So persistent muscle tone during REM sleep, which is abnormal and goes along with this picture. Obviously, that's more of a research thing. So the blood pressure cuff gives you something you can actually do with the patient in your office. And if that didn't confuse you, I can try again.
I'll ask them to contact you offline for further confusion.
Okay.
We did have somebody write in wondering where they can get the link to this recording. It should be posted within the next 24 hours, and you can find it in our online archive catalog, but you will receive a follow-up email 2 days from now with a link leading directly to the recording. So that was our final pending question, but I'd like to give you the opportunity to make any concluding comments that you'd like.
Well, I want to thank everybody for showing up on the East Coast again with the bad weather, and the questions were excellent. Some of them were even too excellent. I didn't know exactly how to answer them, but they sort of stimulated me to think, and that's always a plus. And I just want to thank Dr. De Palma for inviting me to participate, and Molly for so nicely walking through my technophobia.
It was my pleasure. And Ralph, did you want to wrap up with any final thoughts?
Yes. Murray, you've presented a great combination of good old-fashioned medicine as well as science, and exposed somewhat the clay feet of certain trials that look at diffuse populations or non-precise syndromes and exactly why they turn out this way and have clay feet. I've got to say that having had some misadventures in high-performance aircraft when I was a flight surgeon, that some of these come back, and I can tell you that prazosin helps. So,
great.
So that's a testimonial from an old guy.
I'm so pleased. I'm so pleased. Thanks, Ralph.
We've had 95 people on the call. Some of them have dropped out, but thank you again for this wonderful talk.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure. Truly.
Absolutely. Yes, thank you, Dr. Raskin, and I know Dr. Elaine Peskin is also there to provide some assistance. Thank you for coming on and lending your expertise to the field, and of course, thank you to Dr. De Palma for organizing this session as well as all of our TBI presentations. So please keep an eye on your emails for further announcements on our next session. And, of course, thank you to our attendees for joining us today. I am going to close out the session now, and as I mentioned before, please wait just a second while the feedback survey populates on your screen and answer just a few questions for us. We do look closely at your responses, and it helps us improve presentations as well as the program as a whole. So once again, thank you for joining us, everybody, and have a great rest of the day. Thank you, Murray. Thank you, Ralph.